Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Birju. I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken call. Welcome and thank you for joining us. Today, our special guest speaker is Claudia Bernardi, and someone who really embodies the theme here. The theme is Art for Political Change. And since we have the pleasure of a remarkable new moderator today, Julie, I'd love to turn it over to you to introduce Claudia and get started in the conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, so I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to introduce Claudia with great honor. Claudia Bernardi is an internationally renowned artist whose work is in the field of human rights and social justice. Claudia was a student at the art school in Buenos Aires during the very violent dictatorship that shaped her as an artist. Claudia's career took a turn when she accompanied the Argentine forensic anthropology team to investigate the 1981 massacre of El Mozote in El Salvador. And they found the remains of 143 people, 136 of them being children. And this led her to create what is now Walls of Hope in El Salvador, which we'll talk about during the call. From here on out, she's created spaces and facilitated communities to come together and heal, find goodness, connection, all while empowering them to create art together. So she's done this from Argentina to the USA to El Salvador, I'm sure a few in between. And like I said, it sounds simple, but what is incredible is during our conversation, you'll see how this work is actually just really transformational and goes beyond just creating art. So welcome, Claudia.
Gracias. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to be here.
Oh, cool. So I wanted to first off I wanted to do a little bit of a background. We have people joining us from all over the world, and I wanted to bring everybody up to speed. I wanted to bring everybody up to speed and kind of ask you if you wanted to share a little bit about what happened in Argentina during that time where you were, kind of just, fill everybody in a historical sense and also a little bit of background, what shaped you in the early stages as a artist.
Sure. Argentina during the 20th century has a very complicated route of history, but I think what you are hoping for me to concentrate upon is what happened from 1976 onwards, which coincides with the taking over of the military junta. So in 1976, a military junta took over the power of Argentina, and they call this process the process of national reorganization. It needs to be said that whoever is interested must really investigate further, because this is just the tip of the iceberg, of course. But in relationship to your question, what we can say is that within the means of this national reorganization that the military junta proposed, it included the abolition of civil rights, the abolition of human rights, and the creation of new legislations, where clearly the military junta was predisposing the country towards a great catastrophe of violence, which led to the actuality and the process in which citizens were considered to be subversive for being against the military junta. What is very different about the history of Argentina during the military junta and some episodes of the history of Latin America, such as the wars in El Salvador and Guatemala, Nicaragua, is that the opposition between the power system and the citizenhood was not due to this economic discrepancy of campesinado, which means the rural areas and privileged rural areas, and the government, like it happened in El Salvador and Guatemala. In the case of Argentina, the so-called dirty war identified the enemy as the citizens who belong to the intelligentsia, the educated middle class, the unions, leaders, teachers, students, etc., etc. And in that context, and because of that, it is possible to say today, after so many years that we have been investigating what happened, that the result of this methodology led to the disappearance of plus minus 30,000 citizens from Argentina. So the concept disappearance was not coined by Argentina, actually. The concept started in Guatemala, but it became very part of our political and cultural realization that in Argentina during the military junta between 1976 and 1983, there were 30,000 people who literally appear to have disappeared. And this is something that came to be investigated when the democratic process came back to Argentina under the president, the new democratic elected president, Raúl Alfonsín. One of his first and most important roles in the history of Argentina was to investigate what happened to the disappeared. In the meantime, during the 8 years of dictatorship, there were all these episodes comments saying, well, the disappeared are safe in Denmark or they are, you know, somewhere in Latin America. The investigations produced from 1984 on, coinciding with the new democratic government, led to a completely different conclusion, which was that the disappeared had been taken to clandestine centers of detention where there had been torture, they had been executed extrajudicially, and they had been buried illegally in mass graves. In the context of this investigation, the creation of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team is prominent. In the early years of the democracy, a forensic anthropologist from this country, Dr. Clyde Snow, came to Argentina to investigate these cases of disappearance, and he wasn't able to reach scientists who would work with him, but he was able to reach a group of very young undergraduates at the time, 4 students of anthropology and 2 students of medicine, and unbeknownst to them at the time, they became and they have been the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team, whose main effort has been and is to investigate cases of violations of human rights against civilian population. So the team, the Argentine Forensic Team, has investigated the case of Argentina and, as you also mentioned, Julie, outside Argentina, like in the case of El Mozote. My connection to the team is adjacent to the participation of my sister, Patricia Bernardi, who is a member of the Argentine Forensic Team since those first years. So I have been aware of the work they have done, and through the work they have done, I have been able to see a very tragic aspect of the history of Argentina and the world.
Wow, yeah. Now, bringing us to what kind of shaped a lot of what you're doing was when you went to El Salvador and with the Argentine Forensic Team and, you know, kind of went through that mass grave. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes. In 1992... the peace accords were signed in Chapultepec, Mexico, ending 12 years of war in El Salvador. The war in El Salvador started in 1980 and ended that 16th of January of 1992 with a peace agreement, which was quite incredible at the time and scenes. When the peace accords were signed, the two parts of the civil war, meaning the government of El Salvador and the army of El Salvador and the guerrilla armed forces, the Farabundo Martí Liberation National Front, the two parts that had fought this war agreed, accepted the creation of the United Nations Truth Commission that would have as its mandate to investigate violations of human rights perpetrated by the two sides of the war during the 12 years of civil war in El Salvador. When the United Nations Truth Commission was formed, they investigated the possibility of carrying on a number of exhumations that would be, in legal terms, paradigmatic, meaning that it would bring information about the history of El Salvador in an exemplary way, so to speak. And mm-hmm. that is how the massacre at El Mozote was selected. El Mozote was a small community located in the north of Morazán, which is the northeastern part of the country. It is important to mention, however, that El Mozote massacre was not the only massacre that took place in that area. In fact, there are over 300 massacres reported as having taken place in only that portion of the country. But the case of El Mozote was different and noticeable for many reasons. One is for the scale of victims, which was over 1,000 of victims acknowledged having been killed in the area. And also because the peculiarity of this event has to do with the fact that there is only one survivor, and the whole case of investigation was opened upon her testimony. Her name was Rufina Amaya Márquez. She is the sole survivor of the massacre at El Mozote. So the United Nations Truth Commission considered that that massacre was very important to further investigate and nominated the Argentine forensic team to carry on the exhumation. My participation with the team was as the creator of the archaeological maps, which renders visually the location of the human remains, the associated objects, and in this case also the location of ballistic evidence. So visually one sees in the maps what happened, and that was my role. The exhumation took a long time, was from pretty much August, September, to the end of the year of 1992. The judge pertinent in the case decided that the first building to be exhumed would be a small building which was adjacent to the building of the church. That building was called the convent, or has been known as the convent, because this is the place where the priest would change garments once every 2 weeks when he would come to the to El Mozote to give mass. According to the testimony of Rufina, she saw from where she was staying at the early part of the massacre that men and male teenagers were taken out of the church. Some were killed in the main square, some of them were beheaded, and some others were taken into this small building. She does not know why this happens, but in her original report, and as a witness, this is what she says. The outcome of the investigation that the Argentine Forensic Anthropology team produced is actually quite different. What the Argentine team found are not the human remains of male teenagers or adult males, but the exhumation provided clearly the evidence that in that building there were at least 143 people, of whom 136 were children under the age of 12, with an average age of 6 years of age. And this discrepancy between Rufina's testimony and what the Argentine forensic team found may be connected to the fact that at one point towards the end of the massacre, Rufina is in hiding, and she no longer sees what is happening. She hears, but she doesn't see. So what we can conclude, what it can be concluded, is that the children were kept alive until the end and were taken into this building, introduced into the building, and killed inside the building. There are ballistic evidence that produces the possibility to identify at least 27 shooters shooting at the same time inside the building from the two original apertures of the building, which is a door in the south wall and a window in the west wall. So that's what I just produced to you. What I gave you is a summary of the massacre's investigation and the exhumation.
And
what happened to me after exhuming children for more than 2 months and finding human remains that were so little, they didn't seem human. To me, the question that kept on coming back frequently and more frequently as the exhumation went on was what it would be like to come back to this place and create art with children of the same age we are exhuming today.
Wow.
At the time, it was unreachable, the thought. It felt so impossible. It almost felt obscene in a way, obscene in the Greek way of seeing, out of the scene, right? Not seeable, totally impossible. But the concept stayed with me. And after the exhumation ended, and after many years passed, I was able to go back to Perkin, which is a community located 4 kilometers north from where the community of El Mozote was located and still is located, because from 1992 El Mozote has been repopulated. And in that community of Perkin, as a community effort, we have created what we call the School of Art and Open Studio of Perkin, which internationally is being known as Walls of Hope. And it is an incredible chance that life has given a lot of us to do exactly that, which in 1992 was impossible to think. We are creating art with children of the same age that we exhumed. And we have created a number of projects at the very village of El Mozote. Most prominently in 2006, in commemoration of the 25 years since the massacre had occurred, we created a community in the new building of the church in which the whole community participated, men, children, youth, adults, etc., elderly, and it was a remarkable experience. It's one of those moments in which one thinks, or I think, that what art conquers, politics can never conquer. And in a personal journey, a moment of incredible recognition and humbleness towards the power of people coming together to tell the story, and in this case, the story of their community, which must be said, interestingly, did not address the massacre. It addressed the mural, which is huge, is more than 17 meters long and 6 meters high, does not include the massacre as it seems. It includes the history of how the community was before the massacre took place, and it also addresses what the community wants for the future. And that in itself is incredibly transformative. And, of course, I should also mention at this point that in this case and in all cases of community work and creation of art, my role is always that of a facilitator. I do not paint, I do not suggest, I do not lead the project. My only role is to ask, what do you want? What do you want to say in this mural? What do you want to tell? What story do you want to tell? So this is how the project starts at El Mozote and in every other mural project.
I found it so interesting when we were talking, just going a little bit off of what you just said, how you create a space and empower people to come together, and, you know, 99% of them have never, you know, or say, I can't draw, I've never painted, I don't know how to do this. And they come together and they share, you know, they share a commonality, usually something extremely tragic. And they're able to create these massive murals that look like they were painted by professional artists. Mm-hmm. Yet it's all people who, at the beginning of the entire situation, are even reluctant to hold a pencil. And that, to me, was kind of where I realized the transformation of it. And, you know, I remember when we were talking about it, I asked you how this happened, and you said, I have no idea. It just happens. Like, these people just are able to recreate this in their own way and are able to paint it and do it magically, and you don't touch a single pencil or stencil or anything. So could you talk a little bit about that and maybe give us some examples in some of the work that you've done, how this has shown through?
Mm-hmm. It is a mystery. I embrace the mystery. But it's absolutely true. I mean, the people that come to create the art projects, as you say, probably 99%, if not 100% of the time, have no idea. They don't have a history of being connected to art. They haven't done it. We have worked in Guatemala, in which the group of women we were working with have never seen a brush. And this is a beautiful moment in which Doña Elena from Nebach looked at me with astonishment, and she said, the brush is like a candle. It has light on one end. And I said, ay, Doña Elena, this is such a beautiful image. I will tell the story many times, but I always will give credit to who said it. So that's Doña Elena. But yes, I mean, we go from, you know, gathering with people who have never seen even a brush to creating these huge murals, created by a lot of people, which logistically presents a challenge. So in trying to explain how it works, I think it works because everyone is willing to come to terms with finding a thread that unifies the subject. And that already is part of the transformation. The way we work is by building towards consensus, which is very different than working towards democracy. In democracy, you know, you go for that which is the majority. In the work we create, everything that we agree upon has to be accepted by everyone. And that may be arduous, and may be arduous in different parts of the world for different reasons. But once the group arrives to an understanding of what the main subject is, and they accept that and embrace that, then we can move forward, and then we don't go back. And in that already, there is a great moment of, I think, for lack of a better term, arrival to trust that, mm-hmm. yes, we are all in this together, and this is how we are going to cement, so to speak, this huge new edifice of the mural. That's one part. The other part is that the methodology we pursue is by having exactly, you know, trying to respond to the question, what is this mural going to talk about? And people start, you know, sharing their ideas, proposing their ideas, what is always very potent in the project is that once that starts happening, the participants realize that their personal idea is very similar to other people's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
When we can create these similarities, then I suggest that those groups that have similar ideas would get together and create a larger sketch or a larger drawing. And this is a moment of great agility in which many ideas are starting taking shape at the same time.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but when you say ideas, what do you mean? Like they're all drawing the same thing? Or
Not necessarily. I mean, in the case of El Mozote, for instance, this was very clear. There was an understanding from the beginning, and it wasn't easy to arrive to that, I should tell you. But there was at one point an understanding that they didn't want to talk about the massacre. Okay, very good. They don't want to talk about the massacre in the mural. What do you want to talk about? They wanted to talk about how the community was before the massacre. Well, very well. So what shape will that take? So they created buildings, they created crops, they created areas mm-hmm. in which what it shows is the planting, the harvesting, and the industrializing of a fiber that comes from a plant similar to the aloe vera. In El Salvador, it's called Enequén. So that whole part is a beautiful part of the mural, but it has many layers. The planting of the Enequén, the harvesting of the Enequén, the creation of the hammocks with the thread, etc., etc. So mm-hmm. we had a group of people working on plantations. We have a group of people working on buildings. We have mm-hmm. a group of people working on ideas for the future. We had a group of people working on the cascade. There is a beautiful waterfall that comes from the extreme left into the building. And that is how we form the groups of people working simultaneously on ideas that later will find its way in the actual surface of the building.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, but you managed to do it all. How long does this take to get these people who have never touched art, who half of them, some of them have never even seen a paintbrush, and then later to create this amazing, amazing mural on a massive wall? How long does that take?
No, it really depends. This project in El Salvador, because we painted it during the rainy season, which it's not recommendable, it took us about maybe a month. Mm-hmm. But there are some projects, including the one in Argentina that the Pollination Foundation helped fund,
mm-hmm.
That took 3 days. And it's a huge mural painted by more than 50 people, and they're all Argentines, which should be taken in consideration, strong opinionated people. But what I do want to remark here, Julie, is that it is never my work alone. We are always part of a huge consortium of people. I am one link in a big change of people working together, and that's the other part of I would choose this to also support your question of how does this work. It works because it is never one person's project. It's mm-hmm. always a consortium effort. And when one sees that, it's as important the role of the artist as the role of the person who prepares the wall, as the role of each of the participants, then the hierarchies are non-existent. We are all in the same place at the same time trying to work the best we can. And what I just said, the rainy season is incredibly challenging. If we didn't have Don Jose and Don Tomas to cover us, with the very precarious but yet workable tent, the whole mural would have been demolished the first day of rain. So, you know, their participation was as important as the participation of the participants, as the participation of, you know, myself as someone who is the facilitator, etc. And I think that that process in which we all recognize, without talking about it, but we recognize that, yes, we are a consortium working together, that to me is hugely transformative. It does build the trust in one another. And I think at that point, it's very common to recognize, and it's always beautiful to recognize this, that we are doing the best we can. Maybe some can better, can less, whatever, but we all are working, hoping that what we produce will be the best we can do. And that is beautiful.
Yeah. How have you noticed this type of unspoken transformation that happens? If you could give us some examples of times in which participants who are creating these murals, you know, times that you saw this transformation or witnessed it.
Well, yes. I would say always in one way or the other. But in talking about one particular project, let's focus on the project that the Pollination Foundation helped fund, which is a project in Argentina. This was a hugely challenging project for many reasons. The project was presented as working with relatives of people who have disappeared, who have been able to retrieve the human remains of their loved ones through the efforts and through the work of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology team.
Mm-hmm.
When one talks about families of the disappeared in Argentina, there are thousands, but this particular group of relatives is smaller because it is directly connected to the work the Argentine Forensic Anthropology team has been able to conduct since about, let's say, 8 years ago, which is DNA testing.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, the Argentine Forensic team has collected the human remains found in mass graves, and they are at the office of the Argentine team's headquarters. But it hasn't been possible until recently, DNA comparison. DNA comparison occurs by comparing blood samples of the relatives with DNA material from the human remains.
Mm-hmm.
So from, let's say, about eight years ago until now, over 700 identifications had been possible. And the process in which it happens is through DNA testing. It comes up the evidence that the human remains number, let's say 524, belongs to whom in life was such and such a person, because the DNA from the human remains matches the blood samples of the family that, you know, the blood samples are kept in the National Bank of Blood Samples in Argentina. Okay, so that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm.
What I proposed to the Argentine team then was to work with the families of people who disappear, who had been able to retrieve the human remains in recent years. The very challenging part of this project is that the mural was going to be painted in the largest ex-clandestine center of detention and extermination in Argentina, which is known as ESMA, Escuela Superior de Mecánica de la Armada, the Mechanical Navy School. During the 8 years of the military junta in that group of buildings belonging to the Navy Mechanical School, the largest clandestine center of detention and extermination operated. And it is known that at least 5,000 people passed through that place, very few of whom emerged alive. So for the families of the disappeared to be working in the same place where their family members had been, was incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. And we learn, I didn't know this from the beginning, but I learned in the process that there were two people who had been in prison there and had emerged alive, which is very rare, from that clandestine center of detention. And I Julie, could not imagine how could that be possible. I mean, this was incredible. I so much appreciated. I felt so humble by the courage of these people. We were painting the mural in the building that is called Latin America Initiative for the Investigation of Disappeared People. En español es Proyecto Iniciativa, Iniciativa Latinoamericana para la Investigación de Personas Desaparecidas. In that building is where the blood samples will be kept in custody for now on for further DNA comparison. So it's something very connected to the history of the participants. Mm-hmm. So with that as a preamble, there are already many possible answers to the question of transformation. You know, how can one enter to that building to create art? It's incredible. It's like, you know, how is this possible? Mm-hmm. We are so lucky. We are so historically privileged to be able to enter now and do this. Mm. Now, that in itself is a very hopeful part. Now, in terms of challenges, to work with 53 and then it was almost 60 people who have never done art, but who are also Argentines, which tend to be in disagreement before they do agree on anything. That's the natural character. It was really interesting because there were so many ideas that had a very strong political component, which was totally understandable. But it was an interference with the creation of the mural because the initial way in which the group started associating itself was not through consensus, but through, I wouldn't say opposition, because I think ideologically they were very much in alignment, but just as an attitude, you know, not necessarily prompt to come to consensus. And we had only 3 days to work, so the challenges there to me was to try to see at all times that which was what they were in accordance. So there was a lot in which they were not in agreement. My role was trying to highlight that they all agree upon. And my role was that, just to say, okay, let's not focus on what you disagree. Let's focus on what you do agree. Oh, yeah, we do agree on that one, don't we? So, yeah, you do agree on this one. Maybe you should follow with this line of thought. What do you agree upon? And then in response to your question, how one visualizes the change, this happens here and in all murals, in all projects that I have worked on. There is a moment in which the mural talks. There is a moment in which everyone loves the mural. They can hardly believe they are doing it. And my role at that moment is always take a step back, which is so hard. You know, they're all painting like 20 centimeters away from the wall. I said, take a step back. Look at what you're doing. And that moment is magic. That is the moment in which the mural talks. The mural has its own identity. And the people who work on it, without perhaps realizing through reasoning, but realizing emotionally, love it, and they cannot believe that it's so beautiful, and they are doing it, and it's looking incredible, and yes, they want to do more, and then this is a time in which no one talks, no one eats, no one goes to the bathroom, everyone is working on the mural. It's very amazing. It happens always. How it happens, I have no idea. But it happens always. It happens always that there is a moment in which the artwork has its own identity. It's very similar, I suppose, to the magic moment of giving birth, in which you're seeing the child. I have never been a mother, so I cannot talk. But you know, seeing that something that you have a participation in, but on the other hand, it's also a mystery, is taking place. And always happens. So the mural in Buenos Aires at ex-ESMA is one of those miracles in which, who would say, I mean, can you imagine what happened there, the history of the place, and then to have the participants working in that and loving it and feeling proud of it and feeling appreciative of what they have done. The many emails going back and forth acknowledging this process I don't know. We don't have in life too many moments of this kind of happiness, but this is one of them. And then, you know, as one of the participants said, and I share this with you, so I'm sorry for you. But
no, please do.
One moment, you know, they were painting, and as I passed by, one of the participants, who is a son of two disappeared parents, the father has been recovered, the mother is still disappeared. So this young man, age maybe 36 now, has both parents disappeared. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Do you know what is the best thing about this mural?" Sort of nonchalant. I said, "No, what is the best thing about this mural?" And he said, "Well," and he never stopped painting, right, while he answered. I said, "The best part of this mural is that for people like us who grew up thinking of us as victims, and in a way we are, but here you come and you tell us that we are muralists and we believe you." That is the best part of the mural. And I think that is also part of the transformation. I couldn't have said it better than he did, in that there's also a different way of looking at oneself, thinking, "Oh, I just did this." And then most frequently, and this case was one, they want to replicate the experience. They want to do it again. And they did. They did another one. And you know, maybe we continue doing that. And I think it is very likely, and this would be the second part of the evolution, which very frequently happens. The best that can happen from now on is that some of the participants would reinitiate and reimplant the same kind of experience in other parts of their communities. And I think they are thinking about that. We always think that the best part of any of these projects is that it will have a life after this one. And, you know, okay, it's like a sourdough mentality. Okay, this is the sourdough starter. Get it, use it, distribute it, make it different, and let us know about it. That is what we would like to think of.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's so magical that, you know, what keeps going through my head as you share these stories, and unfortunately there's not enough time for you to share all of them, but, you know, you mentioned some of the ones that happen in the United States with, you know, folks who had experienced segregation and reintegration, quote-unquote, and just all sorts of communities and, you know, people who have never seen a paintbrush to people who, you know, came from really educated parents who were disappeared and spoke different languages. And you talked to me about some murals that you created where you didn't speak the language of the muralists.
Exactly.
And they still, and at the end of the day, there's this like underlying pattern of creation and cooperation and healing that happens, to the point where, you know, you mentioned that aha moment that everyone experiences, and then they quickly go back to, like, you know, the story of the mural as it's being told to them. And that to me is what is when you see this about art, and it's so intangible. You can't, you know, you can't make facts about it, and you can't do it, but experiencing it just really gives you the ability to see how powerful it is. And I'm just so honored and grateful that you're, you know, that you've gotten this space and that you've facilitated it. And it's amazing. It really is amazing.
But do remember this. I never work alone. It's always
right.
A consortium. And that has a lot to do.
Mm-hmm.
The project that you're mentioning is a project in Panzos in Guatemala, where my colleagues from El Salvador and I work with 75 K'iche' men, women, youth, and children, survivors of the massacre of Panzos. They don't speak Spanish. We don't speak K'iche', or hardly, just to say hello, you know, very polite, to be polite. We needed two interpreters, but two interpreters for 75 people, that's very little. And yet, we did communicate perfectly through art. It was incredibly potent, incredibly potent. And the mural is huge. It's over 36 meters. Almost a whole side. And on the other side of that wall is where the massacre had occurred. So this was amazing. I didn't know we were working there. I didn't know we were working with people who had been in hiding for 30 years. There was so much to be said. I don't think we could have communicated in any other way but in art and with the depth that we did, if we were to be resourcing on words and language, just because of, you know, the interpreting part. It would have taken months, and we did it in less than a week, and the mural is still there. Yeah, I don't know how it happens. It's really mysterious, but that's, you know, one of the mysteries that I am very ready to embrace, and maybe I don't want to know how it works. It works.
If I could jump in there, Julie, I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I think that it might be an interesting time to open this up to the broader group. So I wanted to shift over into a Q&A session, and I'd also love to ask a question myself, if that's all right, Julie.
Oh, please.
I've been really curious in hearing about these reflections and the stories, the powerful stories that you're sharing here, Claudia. I'm curious what your own relationship with healing has been as a result of these experiences that you've gone through at an external level.
I have a hard time thinking about healing of these huge catastrophes. In fact, I have to say that I don't think one can heal after going through these enormous tragedies. But what one can do is learn how to live with it in a way that is luminous, just to say an adjective. And for me, the experience when trying to explain this, it comes to mind with an image, and I think about someone who is amputated, you know, someone who may have an accident and doesn't have a leg anymore. Well, that person will never grow another one, that's a fact, but that doesn't necessarily prevent the person from learning how to dance differently. And I actually have seen that. I saw that. The reason why I'm thinking of this image is because I saw from all places in the Carnival of Brazil, the middle of the main parade, one of the big stars of one of the Escola de Samba was a man that didn't have a leg. And I thought, you know what? This is a great image. This is synthesizing a lot of what I try to say. He didn't have a leg, but he learned how to dance wonderfully with only one. And to me, that is relevant in that I think it is important. Maybe I'm saying this as an Argentine, and the way Argentines look at history and memory, we are not willing to change the page, to turn that page. We are committed to look at harm in a very, you know, very close way. And that has led to a number of very important outcomes, including the trials in Argentina. So when one talks about healing as embedderment, I have confusion. But what I can say in relationship to your question is that for me, going from Guatemala to El Salvador to Northern Ireland to Serbia to Mexico, Ciudad Juarez, all these places that have in common an enormous the presence of a violent history, what I see is that art will not mitigate the violence and art will not necessarily change the history of the country, but art will probably change, even if in a slight way, the reason for which one chooses to be in association to other people. And that is the beginning of a community change. So knowing that has helped me personally at many layers in my own life, in the way I teach, the reason for which I teach, the creation of the school, the trusting of art. I mean, this, you know, it's those are very important layers that may or may not have to do with the praxis of art that is most frequently understood. I think art is a huge contributory, very potent tool of reorganizing communities. And if there is a process of healing, it is a process of healing of how we see the possibility of the future with less tragedy than what we have been seeing in our recent past. And that in itself is a transformative process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that, Claudia.
I was curious to talk a little bit about the school that you founded and directed and is now being ran by community members. If you could just give our audience a little bit of background on that and how it works and what it's doing and maybe even provide the website where people can go and see a little bit more about that.
Well, the School of Art in Perkin is probably what brings me the largest amount of hope and pride altogether. And I think, as you mentioned, the most successful part of the school is that is today it's locally run school. I am affiliated with the school at all layers, but the school is being run by four local artist teachers from the area of Morazan. The school was born in 2005, so from the time of the massacre at El Mozote in 1992, it took many years until this project was, the little seed of the project was planted in Perkin. From the beginning, it has always been a community-based project in such a way that it functions as a very different school. There are no schools like this one. And as a matter of fact, it has become a model. It's called now the Perkin model, which has been investigated and studied in universities in the U.S., in Switzerland, Argentina, etc. What is different about this school is, first of all, that it's open to all members of the community, children, youth, adults, in a place and in a country and in a community that is hugely polarized by local politics and the tragic legacy of the war. We have been very clear from the beginning by saying our work is political, but it is not partisan. And that is very, very potent and difficult to sustain. But from the beginning, we felt that we needed to clarify that our role as being part of the school was not to take sides of the war. It was not to take sides religiously, because the community is also divided between the evangelical churches and the Catholic Church, and to point the accent towards the welcoming of mostly children and youth. The participants of the school, the teachers, artists, are America Argentina Baquerano, Claudia Berenice Flores Escolero, Rosa del Carmen Argueta, and Don Amilcar Varela. the four of them are from Morazan, and the four of them started being students of the school, and then apprentices of the school, and then teachers of the school. So the whole process of learning about art is also very different than what we have traditionally in art schools here. They enter knowing nothing, but then out of practice they became artists, practitioners, and also community organizers. The way we work is by having town meetings with the community and asking, what is what you want? So there are layers in which we have weekly classes that go from drawing, painting, recycled materials. We have a very popular class of wood sculpture. Don Amilcar teaches that class, and our major concern of the wood sculpture class is to train young boys and girls to become independently able to sustain themselves through these kind of activities instead of having to come to the United States, which appears to be the only way they can see their future. It's really tragic what is happening in El Salvador today and has happened since the end of the war. So although it's a tiny little amendment, so to speak, what we can say is by learning how to work with wood, by creating furniture, etc., boys and girls have become independent, have created an economic independent life. This is incredible. We are very proud about that. So in other words, how the school works is by identifying a desire of the community or a need in the community, and then create art about it. And that has many shapes. One other calamity of the post-war period is that because many of the parents come here and leave the children behind with elderly family members, very frequently there are, you know, many, many children living together who are cousins or half-cousins under, you know, the guidance of one adult who usually is elderly. And what we have been able to identify is that there is a lot of inner violence in that family. Sometimes there is case of, you know, sexual violence, etc. That is a problem that we see consistently happening more now than 10 years ago, let's say. So we are looking at that as an opportunity to create art about something that maybe cannot be even spoken in words, but that is how we create the artwork. So it's very, as I said, very different to how curriculum is created or curricula is created in art schools, in which, you know, we work with a number of visions that relate more to the evolution of the art world. In Perkin, we work with, it for us, is the same to think about the strategy of art than to think about the need that this art needs to be happening right now. We have worked with campaigns of vaccination. We have worked with local politicians, et cetera, et cetera. Not taking sides, actually, but, you know, working with the idea of what it means to take a stance, you know, for Women's Day. Oh, well, so many things, so many examples I can give you. None of the art projects that are created in Perkin are exempt from the reality of everyday life. And I think that's a huge difference. The webpage of the school is www.wallsofhope.org. And I would like everyone to visit the webpage. The webpage is being run by the beautiful, wonderful artists from Perkin. I am totally inept at technology, so they run it. I read it. I don't do anything. They run it, which is incredible. I mean, that's another layer of how they have educated themselves to do this. They are perfect organizers, administrators, wonderful teachers. I don't have enough words of praise to use for them, but I so dearly love them and admire them. It's a great honor to work with them.
Thank you. And I'm curious again, just turning that camera inwards from looking out into all these powerful examples that you've experienced, how has your own capacity to feel pain evolved over the years?
It's a paradox. I think the membrane that divides my being of the rest of the world has become very, very thin, and sometimes is almost a little dangerous. But the paradox comes to the recognition that predisposition or even desire to be closer and closer to the origin of pain has also given me the opportunity to be more hopeful every time. And I don't know how that happens. But for me, it's recurrent to think that in the project, like if I were to tell you what the projects are from now on, during the year, let's say, the ones that I'm planning are all projects that are very, very close to tragedies from working, let's say, to be concrete, in Honduras with families of people who disappear in the crossing to the border, the U.S.-Mexican border, which is a huge problem. There are countless numbers of disappearances to maybe going to work with the families of the 43 assassinated students from Ayotzinapa, to going to Bosnia-Herzegovina to be working in the commemoration of the 20 years of the massacre of Srebrenica. So many different parts of the world all have the same tragic history in recent years. Why would I choose that? One wonders. I also wonder, why is it? But I think it is because it is implicit that there is also this trust that something wonderful will happen, and always has. I've been doing this kind of work for 20 years, and although the challenges of each project seems to be enormous and long list of problems to resolve, the outcome has always been very beautiful, very hopeful, for lack of better term. And also, and this is very important, it has served the participants to do something with it later. The project never stops being the project itself. Mm. It has taken many different lives. Communities have taken it in different ways. But it's always the case that the project doesn't end in itself. It becomes that something else that I totally trust that will happen, and it's entirely their thing. I am an observer of that, but I trust that this is another component of how the project will grow, and that is very beautiful. So I think the layer of pain is near, but the vicinity to this pain has given me more opportunity to be more hopeful than ever before. Does that make sense? Maybe.
It does. Thank you.
It's hard to say. I live in a world of paradoxes, but maybe because I'm Argentine, I welcome them. I don't need a lot of answers. I need a lot of questions. Maybe that's what it works.
That's funny. it's interesting because I just think of what you, when you talk about what it is, you know, the paradoxes and stuff. And you said two things in the call that kind of rang true to me, which one was it's that historical privilege that you just feel honored to be there, to be able to paint or express, for these people to be able to express themselves in a way that obviously was not possible before. And the other aspect of that was, it's what's being expressed cannot be, half the time cannot be expressed in other ways beyond art.
Mm-hmm.
which kind of makes both of those aspects so unique and kind of magical in itself.
Really, Nick, I gave you a good example of that. When we were working in Guatemala in 2008 with a group of about 35 women, indigenous women, survivors of sexual violence during the armed conflict, these women also came from different regions of Huehuetenango, therefore spoke different languages, and we had interpreters. And they all seemed to be simultaneously surprised to recognize that what happened to them had happened to other women. They didn't know that, and they didn't know that it happened in such a similar way because the methodology of the army was quite systematic. At any rate, towards the end of the mural project, which is beautiful and incredible for the amount of information that it provides, one of the women said, you know, when people from outside come and they ask us what happened to us and they write in their notebooks what we tell them, we have to believe that what we tell them is what they write. But in reality, we don't know that because we are illiterate. We don't know how to read and write. But when we paint this mural, we know what story we are saying. That is fantastic. And as a matter of fact, that mural went from Huehuetenango to be exhibited at the University of San Carlos in Guatemala. The women went, and I learned this later through emails with the organizer of one of the organizers of ECAP, Equipo Comunitario de Acción Psicosocial, which is the agency that invited us to work with these women. And they talk about the moment of transformation, for these women haven't acknowledged that they are illiterate and feeling shame for that, to come as the central piece of the University of San Carlos to talk about what this mural speaks about. And then the mural made it into the president's house when Álvaro Colón was the president. That was the journey that the mural took, because it tells the story in a remarkable, vivid way, and also very beautiful. It's fantastic. But that is, to me, that's an incredible moment of transformation in which they realize what is the mural for them. It is a book of history without words. Now, not to say that poets or writers cannot arrive to the same conclusion, but the indigenous communities, being illiterate, would not be able to do it through the written word. Maybe they could use the help of someone who writes to tell the story, but painting is far more direct and acts as a different kind of interaction among the women.
Powerful.
Mm-hmm. And very beautiful. Very beautiful.
Yeah, it's so interesting how you don't think about that, but people who don't have the privilege of writing or reading, or even, you know, what language it's being told in. Maybe they do, but not in the language that's being written in. You're right, they're telling these super intimate stories about terrible, terrible things that have happened in their lives, and they have no proof that what's written down is what they're saying. And that's, it kind of gives you another perspective on the whole multi-layered aspect of what you do.
And this is Birju again. We have a question here from Terry of Ithaca, New York. He says, speaking of paradoxes, it seems paradoxical and yet true that art can be on one hand painful as well as a call to action, and on the other hand, a source of solace at the same time. I'm thinking of works like Picasso's Guernica as an example. Do you find that to be the case, and if so, why do you think that is the case?
What a great question, and thank you for the opportunity to reflect upon this. I remember in trying to respond to this, which is only a visitation of an answer, I remember reading one not that long ago that Stravinsky said, art that makes us feel makes us hurt. And I love that. I remember, you know, highlighting it and then using it. Art that makes us feel makes us hurt. Meaning maybe the part of the paradox is that art is this very gentle, almost surgical tool that through its beauty cuts sharp in a place that hurts. But because it is also beautiful, it allows us to see beyond the hurt. And I think this is what I see all the time happening in the collaborative mural projects. I also think that in the community mural project, a big component that helps the pain to be possible to witness and transform in images is exactly that we are doing this together. That there is a human interaction that is different than working in solitude as an artist. Not to say that it's better or worse, but I think there's a completely different kind of methodology, and through that methodology of working as a group, one is capable to say and feel differently. In the case of the mural in Argentina that I just described, more than 50 people came to agree, and this is incredible, but the 50 Argentine people agree that a moment of change was when the Argentine forensic team would call them to say that the human remains had been found. And they recognized that that moment was like a thunderbolt on their head. And that's what they painted. They painted what they call el rayazo, the big thunderbolt. I think in response to the caller and about the paradox, part of this possibility to experience deeply the pain and at the same time transform that is that the fact that everyone recognizes that what they feel is that what everyone feels. And that is amazing. You know, usually pain is felt in solitude, which aggravates the pain, I think. And to work in mural projects allows the participants to see that they are slightly less alone because they share that, I think.
Thank you.
It's so interesting when we think about art in the way that it kind of allows us to feel these multidimensional feelings and experience healing and pain at the same time and all of these things. How this is kind of a more of a well, I don't know, explain the question, but it's for those of us who maybe are on the call that are artists or seeking to express themselves through this way or facilitate these types of things, how have you found it most important that you're telling your story or expressing what you're doing in a way that is seen as important and validated? Because I know oftentimes, you know, you bring up art or you bring up the need for these, you know, collaborations to happen, and a lot of people just kind of, you know, they don't find it as important as the political dialogue between, you know, politicians and et cetera, et cetera. So what has been your experience in, you know, the most, what's worked for you in getting the work that's being done to be noticed and given the importance that it deserves?
Well, you know, that opens a big question about how art is being perceived by communities or societies. And, you know, the history of art is wonderful, but it is rather insular, I would say. Historically speaking, I think in the last 50 years, there has been an aperture, and I certainly think that, you know, students of art today have a lot of opportunities to look at art as a far more agile vehicle of constant change. There are fields that are called community arts, et cetera, right? That's actually what I teach at the California College for the Arts. I teach in a department that is called community arts. So we see that now there are more artists thinking about this line of thought. And that is, I think, is very healthy and opens an enormous amount of new possibilities. Still, in terms of funding, for instance, I think community art projects are hugely underfunded, which produces, you know, the inevitable circumstance that artists that may have wonderful visions and desire to work in this field may not be able to do it, because as artists you also need to support yourself. So it would be, you know, an interesting evolution if funding for this kind of projects would be more robust. But then on the other hand, what I seem to be always involved in and working with and documenting is art that is created totally under the radar. There are many, many artists that for a number of circumstances, including political precaution, work under the radar, which means completely not adjacent to the traditional art world. And I suppose there will be a moment in which those two big roads will meet. But at this point, the two are true. The ones that are, you know, opening up towards the recognition of community arts as a new field, and then the other kind of art that is still done under the radar. It has to be in part with, you know, the fragility of political situation in the country where this takes place. So in regards to your question, I think, and I always tell this to the students, the most important thing is to know what you are passionate about. To be a community artist is by definition to be eternally overworked and underpaid. So you better do it because you love it, right? And I always propose the question or the suggestion in trying to find that which is a passion to you. Try to find out what makes you cry of happiness and what makes you cry of anger. And if you can identify those two, you will probably are ready to pull from Ariadna's thread and trying to find out where would you like to put your efforts. And then always have in consideration that whatever you do in community can never be done by only one person. Try to find peers to whom you feel affiliated with, that you can work with. And it is in this creation of these affiliations or consortiums, for lack of a better term, where you can be able to do your work. I'm sure of that. Don't expect money initially. It won't come. but, you know, I have never thought about money as what would make the project possible. I never count with money. If it comes later, it's a great alleviation, but it happens through other layers. And then sometimes funding does come, but it could never be through finding funding first and then doing the project. I think that at least is not my experience. It hasn't been.
Thank you so much, Claudia. And one final question here. As we transition towards the end of our call, the audience that will be listening to your remarks here is very interested in this idea of the inner revolution that meets the outer revolution. And from that perspective, how can we as an audience community be in support to your work?
I don't know how to answer that. I think, well, first of all, I would very much like to say thank you for the opportunity of sharing these thoughts this morning with all of you and the big, big audience. I would love for everyone to visit our webpage, www.wallsofhope.org, learn about what we do, tell us about your part of the world, that maybe there is a project that can occur out of these conversations. We have talked a lot about projects that we have done internationally, but as Julie pointed out, we also have worked here in the United States. And when I talk about we, I'm referring always to the School of Art in Perkin. My dear colleagues and I work
yes.
in community together. So maybe there is a project in your community, whoever is there on the other side of this conversation, that you may identify as something that can be done. Maybe we can work that together. Maybe we can have a conversation about how to do it. Maybe Julie goes and does it. I don't know. but, you know, every opportunity is a good opportunity to start connecting other links in this big chain. And who knows? Maybe this is the next step.
Well, certainly, thank you so much for sharing your presence with us. Julie, thank you so much for leading this conversation towards that soulful direction. It just felt really alive to me as a listener in this process as well. As a spirit of thanks, there's two things we'd like to do as we head towards the closing of this call. One is to have a collective minute of silence to share our gratitude and radiate it outwards into the world. And these are conversations that, for me, have been transformative. And this particular one I found really powerful. So just feeling that gratitude and sharing it outwards. On the count of three, we can all share thank you, Claudia, and share our gratitude there. One, two, three. Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you, Claudia.
Claudia. Blessings.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day, guys, and please join us next weekend for the Awaken Call that will happen next Saturday again at the same time. Have a wonderful day.